From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Hosting this show is hazardous. Before Thanksgiving, I decided that I would just keep it simple this year and order my Thanksgiving meal for one from Rashida Holmes at Bridgetown Roti. By the time we'd finished recording our Thanksgiving show last week, I had decided that I also needed to make gravy, mashed potatoes, and stuffing, if only for the leftovers. In honor of my very full fridge, I want to devote today's show to the two art forms that are most welcoming to leftovers, the sandwich and the taco. Let's start with the bread. There's no denying that the perfectly sliced, fluffy pieces of white bread you see on grocery shelves were in fact made for sandwiches. But behind those innocent loaves lies a deeper history of industrial ingenuity, race, and politics. Back in 2012, I interviewed author and professor Aaron Bobrow-Strain about his book, White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf.
As late as the 1890s, 90% of bread in America was home-baked. At the turn of the last century, only about 10% of bread in the country was baked in bakeries, and that was mostly very small neighborhood city bakeries, usually just one oven, a couple employees. And this was, you have to remember, the most important food in the American diet. About, at that point, at the turn of the last century, about 30% of daily calories came from bread.
So given the fact that there was such a small percentage of small bakeries, how did it happen that these bakeries became under assault by food purists who were convinced that the immigrants running the bakery were passing along typhoid, cholera through the bread?
The late 19th century, early 20th century was a really important time of food activism in the United States, similar today to today in many ways. A lot of people asking questions about where their food came from. Was it safe? What are the perils of a corporate industrial food system? And oftentimes, as with today, I would argue, those questions about food safety and food quality got wrapped up in bigger social anxieties. And I think that the reason why these small bakeries became such a flashpoint for food activists in the early 20th century, right to the point where if you look at newspapers, the New York Times, the LA Times, during this period, you see these big, bold headlines, bread menaces the city, dangerous loaves, you know, lots of kind of sensationalists talking about the danger of these small bakeries. And I really think that the reason why that is has to do with the fact that it got caught up in larger anxieties about immigration at the time. The folks who were running those small bakeries tended to be Southern and Eastern European immigrants, the newcomers to the United States at that time.
So this idea of an industrialized line to create a loaf of bread sort of played into this fear of people touching the dough.
That's right. It was, so bread was industrializing at this time. It was the beginning of the moment when big businessmen were starting to figure out, hey, we can take this artisanal product and put it on an assembly line. It was actually really hard work. Bread was one of the last of the important staple foods in the American diet to become industrialized in that way, to go onto the factory assembly line, because the dough is this living, biological, breathing object that changes with temperature and gusts of air can deflate it. So it was really hard to tame that onto the assembly line. Imagine what Apple was trying to manufacture iPhones, and the parts were growing or shrinking depending on the weather, right? So they're starting to industrialize this bread, and they're able to figure out the technological challenges, things related to temperature controls and high-speed mixing and chemical additives. But then they have to convince people to eat this new kind of bread, right? This is a dramatic shift in the way America gets its most important food. And one of the key ways they're able to convince Americans to eat this new kind of bread is by tapping into that fear and saying, look, our bread is untouched by human hands. That was a very common slogan industrial bakers used. Come look at our factories. They're shining white, full of clean machinery, and the worker never touches the bread. So even if they are a kind of a scary, unfamiliar new immigrant, they're not touching the food.
And just from my own personal travel and also from just interviewing so many people, it seems like cultures that were really affected by extreme scarcity during World War II were so happy to leave grainy, darkened bread behind.
That's really true. And I think that World War II in the United States in particular really saves white bread from itself. Right before World War II, even though white bread was still this symbol of modernity and progress and technology, there were a lot of critics coming out of the woodwork who were saying, wait a second, there's something wrong with this bread. You know, our bread has become too modern, too refined. And they were blaming white bread for causing everything from tuberculosis to criminal insanity. Even many racial eugenicists in the 1930s in the United States accused white bread of making the white race weak. But then during World War II, in the United States, we didn't have the scarcity that you had in other places, like England, where the war loaf, as it was called, was a dark, grainy bread. We didn't have that. Instead, we had the synthetic enrichment of bread. The U.S. government, along with baking industry experts, decided that white bread was going to become a weapon of war for us. Because the nutritional status of Americans going into World War II out of the Depression was pretty miserable. As much as we like to romanticize the diets of the past, the Depression-era diet was horrific in the United States in many ways. So the government decided that we needed to do something about that, and the way we're going to get vitamins to the most possible people as fast as possible is through white bread. So the idea of synthetic enrichment is born. And then there's this massive government and industry, public-private partnership to create propaganda and really sell Americans on the idea that industrial breads enriched with synthetic vitamins is a vital, strong weapon of war. It will make us a vigorous nation.
Let's talk about the loaf itself for a minute. Has the look and feel of white bread changed a lot over the years?
I've struggled to try to figure that out, obviously, because all we have are descriptions. So there's a number of things I was able to find out. One is that a bakery scientist today told me that actually the white bread of the 1950s, if we could compare it to a loaf of white bread today, would have been whiter because of the addition in the present of more of the grain as a kind of way to cheapen the production process in the present. The other thing that happens in the 1920s, 1930s, is that the loaf of bread gets streamlined and made sleek. It stops looking like a loaf of bread that puffed up out of a pan and kind of has that mushroom top. But in an effort to kind of make the loaf look modern and technological, they streamline the loaf and make it a long, sleek, squarish thing that kind of looks like the Zephyr train.
And what about slicing? When did bread start being sliced? And did that change the way we used it at all?
In fact, there was an invention of sliced bread. We hear that saying all the time. And you can date that pretty precisely to July 6th, 1928 in Chillicothe, Missouri, actually. A nearly bankrupt baker named Frank Bench hooked up with a friend of his who was an equally down-on-his-luck inventor named Otto Rohwedder. And they decide to implement Rohwedder's design for a factory automatic bread slicer at Frank Bench's bakery. And at the time, the entire baking establishment thought that this was just absurd. Like, why would anyone do that? But Frank Bench, he's about to go bankrupt, so he takes a chance. And he installs this bread slicing machine, and the results were just phenomenal. Almost overnight, his sales soar 2,000%, and a reporter on the scene talks about housewife's thrill of pleasure at seeing these new perfectly sliced loaves of bread. This is also a moment where people are beginning to take sandwiches to school and work. And also another big factor behind promoting sliced bread was the advent of the toaster.
Wow, it's so interesting. You know, you take something that seems so simple and it has so much that's sort of like waves that ripple out from it. It's really a fantastic book. Thank you so much, Aaron.
Thank you, Evan.
Aaron Bobrow-Strain is the author of White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf. Coming up, just as white bread was made for sandwiches, Kraft singles were made for grilled cheese. It's the history of America's grilled cheese obsession with some new takes on the classic sandwich next.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. It wouldn't be a sandwich show without a deep dive into the ultimate comfort, gooey, buttery, delicious grilled cheese. Laura Werlin is the author of a number of books on cheese, and in 2009, I got to talk to her about her early aughts book, Great Grilled Cheese, 50 Innovative Recipes for Stovetop, Grill, and Sandwich Maker.
So, you know, grilled cheese feels like a staple in American cooking, but is there an actual origin story for a real great grilled cheese sandwich?
Well, you know, there are several stories, and so it's a little bit about who you want to believe. There are many stories that trace back to England in various ways, one of which is that they used to do, and probably still do, open-faced cheese sandwiches, which they would then put under what we call the broiler, but they called the grill. So those were called grilled cheese sandwiches. Later in this country, around the 1930s, I think, possibly 40s, this company called Kraft, that you might have heard of, created the American cheese slices. And so sometimes Kraft is actually credited with having started what we know of as a grilled cheese sandwich.
Because they created that perfect slice that fits on the bread.
Yes, I don't think it was a coincidence that it fit perfectly on two slices of white bread.
Yeah, I don't think so either. The idea of buttering both sides and then cooking it in a pan then, do you think that was actually a Kraft recipe?
Well, I know there was a Kraft recipe. Whether that was the first original one, I don't know. There were these sandwiches that ladies, as they called them then, I guess we still do, but in a different context, created, and they would put them, they were closed, and they were, I don't know if they were buttered or not, I think they were though, and they were put in chafing dishes so they were served at luncheons, and they were little dainty sandwiches, which later they discovered their husbands would eat as well, and so they became popular in that way. But that was definitely a closed sandwich that had cheese in the middle and probably some sort of fat and presumably butter on the outside.
What kind did you grow up with? Because I'm finding, as we've asked chefs and people who work for the show to talk about, you know, their grilled cheese sandwich, and everybody seems to have a slightly different permutation.
Well, I would like to say that I grew up on gourmet cheese and artisan bread, but that would not be true. Instead, my mother was influenced by Kraft, just like so many Americans. And so I grew up with the American cheese slices in between two slices of Wonder Bread. And it was enough for me as a small girl to entice me toward anything with melted cheese. And I made one of those not very long ago in the course of writing my book, and found that the as much as I like good cheese and bread, that bite of nostalgia had an emotional value that I never would have imagined.
Oh, that's so interesting. Let's talk for a minute about some non-American varieties, because even a quesadilla you could think of as a grilled cheese sandwich.
The fact is that tortillas sell more than many kinds of bread in this country. And so depending on what culture you're from, there is some version of grilled cheese. In Mexico, it would be a quesadilla. In France, you know, we're familiar with the croque-monsieur, which is cheese and ham, basically. Spain has its own version. Of course, in Italy, you have all of the different panini, which usually have some form of cheese on them, you know, melted cheese and bread. And so in the end, there are almost every culture that has dairy has a version of a grilled cheese sandwich.
What about Welsh rarebit?
Well, that's, a variation on the theme. That, of course, is bread that has a melted cheese mixture that usually has beer in it and some dried mustard. And then it's heated and then kind of poured over the bread. So that's kind of a combination of grilled cheese meets fondue, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yum. So are you a purist? Is your thing cheddar or American on white bread?
No, that's why I could write a book with 50 recipes for grilled cheese sandwiches. No. If I'm a purist, it would be in the cheeses that I select to use, meaning that I am, you know, a big, big fan of American artisan cheeses. And so I will choose a, you know, Wisconsin Gouda or a special cheese from somewhere that I know is a good melting cheese, and I will use that on a bread that I know I would like to eat, whether or not it was on a grilled or part of a grilled cheese sandwich.
The book is quite wonderful. Thank you, Laura.
You're very welcome, Evan. Enjoy.
Laura Werlin is the author of Great Grilled Cheese, 50 Innovative Recipes for Stovetop Grill and Sandwich Maker.
What do you get when you cross an irreverent wordsmith with a curious, opinionated chef? Tyler Cord. His number 7 sub shops in New York have closed since we recorded this interview a few years ago, but his number 7 restaurant and his cookbook, which has the best title ever, live on. It's called A Super Upsetting Cookbook About Sandwiches.
Hi, Tyler.
Hi.
One of the sandwiches in your book, the most written about, I'm sure, is the broccoli classic. It's roasted broccoli, lychee muchim, feta, fried shallots, pine nuts, and mayo. And at your number 7 sub shop, you can get it as a sandwich or a bowl. And there's a version at your number 7 restaurant in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, too, except it's the double-decker taco version.
Sure.
Talk about the origin of the components of the sandwich.
Sure, although I don't know if it's going to be a very satisfying story. You know, I started with broccoli and I wanted to make a broccoli sandwich, and each ingredient kind of just brought me to the next one. So I wanted to do roasted broccoli, and then it wanted something kind of tart and sweet. And so the lychees are sweet, and then when they're pickled, they're obviously tart. So that seemed like the appropriate thing to do. That tipped it a little too sweet and bright, and so the briny cheese kind of brings it back into a salty place, and then the fried shallots and pine nuts just make everything taste delicious.
And of course, there's mayo.
And mayo is, you know, it's a sandwich, so there's mayonnaise on it. There's not mayo on all the sandwiches, but I like mayonnaise on sandwiches. Especially back when I invented that one, I was putting mayonnaise on just about everything.
So tell us what muchim is and the role of it in your sandwiches.
Sure. I'm using that word in a really loose, weird way. It's a Korean word that basically means like mixed or salad, to the best of my understanding. But it is generally used to describe oimuchim, which is basically like a cucumber salad. And it kind of tastes like a non-fermented kimchi, if you will. So it's spicy and it's, you know, a tiny bit sweet, and it's bright and awesome. So we started out at the sandwich shop using it to make our, like, pickles, like, because we're a New York City sandwich shop, so we needed to have a pickle, but I wanted to do something interesting. So I took this brine, this kind of Korean cucumber brine, and just brined whole Kirby cucumbers in it. And then that kind of led itself to, it turned out that brine was just good on everything, so you know, we ended up brining kind of just anything you can think of in it. But the lychee version is probably my favorite.
Another thing that isn't the muchim but is salad-y, pico de lettuce.
Yeah, that one was just straight marketing.
So what is pico de lettuce?
Honestly, it's just a salad that has just been sitting there for too long.
You know, that's one of my favorite things.
Yeah, it's totally awesome.
It is. Whenever I have people over and there's leftover salad, my favorite thing is to eat it the next morning for breakfast.
I grew up, we always, my mom made a salad for most family dinners at home, and she would make it, and then we would generally wait and eat it after dinner, at which point it was pretty, like, soggy. It is like condensed salad. It's all the flavor of that salad minus a lot of the water. So I didn't know what to call it. And I had a moment of brilliance, or I don't know, or I was just drunk, but it just occurred to me one night. I was like, what if we call it pico de lettuce? And then it's like, it's not salad. It's this like pickled thing. I don't know. And then my wife thought I was crazy, but I put it on the menu and like nobody really reacted to it, which seemed like it wasn't a good or bad thing. It seemed like a good thing because people weren't like, what the hell is that? They just kind of were like, yeah, it's got pico de lettuce on it. Great, I'll eat that. And I just love it.
Let's talk about veggie burgers. Describe what you mean by fake meaty.
Sure. The veggie burgers that are kind of fake meaty are the ones that are, you know, they're the ones that are trying the hardest to be meat. They're like the Boca burgers and those like Dr. Prager's ones and stuff. And they're delicious. I actually really like those. And actually in the fake meat category, I just the other day had that Beyond Meat, the veggie burger that bleeds. It was pretty awesome. So anyway, I do enjoy the fake meat. I feel like a lot of people have attitude about the idea, well, oh, you're vegetarian, so why are you trying to eat this thing that tastes like meat? And it, like, for some reason, it seems to offend people and rub them the wrong way. But if you've ever been vegetarian, and it, like, as somebody who eats meat, and then if you try not to eat meat, having eaten it your whole life, if you try not to eat it for a few weeks, like, something feels totally missing from your meals at some point. And like, I don't know. I went through it too. We had customers at one point. We had the seitan sandwich that I took off the menu, and we had these customers that were like, come on, what are you talking about? You got rid of that. And I was like, well, don't worry. We still have a broccoli sandwich and a cauliflower sandwich. And they were like, all I eat are vegetables. Like, I want something meaty. Anyway, so that's what those burgers are there for. And they are great. And I love them. And they totally work for that. Though I don't necessarily think it's the best way to go about it.
And then you also have an opinion about the ones that are super vegetable-y.
Well, that's kind of the other end of the spectrum too, right? And especially when they get really grainy. Because at some point you're like, well, I'm eating a sandwich that is like a starch inside of two pieces of starch with like some ketchup on it. And that doesn't feel like a thing that I need to be doing. That said, there's nothing wrong with it. I love a samosa just like anybody does. But like when you're eating a burger, you know, you don't necessarily want like a bunch of grains in your bread. That just seems weird.
What was your happy medium?
What I found for that kind of in-between thing is we mix equal parts of seitan that we've, you know, which is wheat protein, which we grind in a food processor, a meat grinder, and then we mix that with equal parts broccoli, and then we just bind it with a little cornstarch and water. We were using eggs, but it turned out that the cornstarch worked just fine, and so that way it's vegan, which is fun. Then everybody can eat it.
Speaking of cornstarch, mm-hmm. You use it in a lot of recipes. Could you explain what it does for you?
So in the case of the burger, it just holds it together so that it's not just a crumbly mess. In general, cornstarch, I mean, it's, you know, it thickens things, which maybe that's the chef in me, but I don't like a sauce to be literally the texture of water. I tend to, you know, want things to have a little more staying power than that. So I tend to thicken them a tiny bit.
I'm sure the cornstarch in that burger must also give it a nice crispness when you sear it.
It does, yeah. So the outside gets nice and crunchy. It's awesome.
You have a deep relationship with broccoli, and I'm wondering why.
I don't know. I mean, like, who can just explain love? I'm not a poet, and I'm not a chemist, but I don't know. It's delicious. It's my favorite thing to eat.
Really? It's your absolutely favorite thing to eat?
I mean, it depends on the day, I suppose, but, like, generally speaking, it's the thing that I want to eat more than anything else.
I wonder if that's because you live in New York and for a lot of the year, it's the only vegetable you can get.
Well, I mean, it's a short growing season here on the East Coast. So most of the broccoli that we eat out here comes from California, but there's always broccoli at the grocery store. There's not always broccoli at the green market, but sometimes there is.
Okay, so I have to ask you where you stand on the hot dog burrito sandwich debate.
Meaning, is a hot dog a sandwich and is a burrito a sandwich?
Yes.
I mean, I obviously love sandwiches, so I'm pretty inclusive. Also, I find, like, those kinds of food debates kind of weird, because does it really matter? I'm probably offending lots of people right now, aren't I? But I tend to include all things in the sandwich category. I can make anything a sandwich if I want it to be. But I guess I also just am very confident.
So on that making anything a sandwich thing, I have to read you an Eddie Wong quote.
Okay.
He said about your cookbook, quote, "I've always said that if you want white people to understand your culture, you should put it on bread." In the tradition of pairing the other with simple carbohydrates, Tyler Cord has written a book about sandwiches so that finally white people may understand the culture of self-hating, neurotic New York chefs.
Yeah.
Isn't that the best quote ever?
It is the best quote. When he sent that to me, I sent it to my editor, and I was like, all right, guys, I got the quote from Eddie. Here it goes. And I was like, are they gonna print that on the back of my book? But they did. And they were actually really excited about it.
And what do you think of it?
What do I think of it? I mean, I don't think, I knew when I asked that there was no way that Eddie was going to write a quote for me that didn't make fun of me at least a little bit. No, I think I love it. I think it's great.
And I do really think it is true that people accept so much that they may be afraid of if it's between two pieces of bread.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. Although, that is something that is like, because it wasn't that long ago that people were like, a broccoli sandwich, what are you talking about? You know, but yeah, but I guess the idea of a sandwich has changed, and that's good. And I maybe I helped with that.
We all need a mission.
We all need a mission and patient investors.
Yeah, that is so true. The sandwiches on your menu have great names. There's like Dan Smith Will Teach You Guitar, which is named after the Dan Smith guitar lesson flyers that are stuck on every telephone pole in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
How do you come up with the names?
Again, I drink a lot, and that makes me think I'm really funny, and then I come up with these clever things that I don't like. A lot of the ones in the cookbook, admittedly, like I was several of them. I've been interviewed a couple times with the book, and a couple people have been like, oh, well, how did you come up with the name for this one? And I'm like, I honestly, I don't remember. Like, I know that it was something really clever, and I'd like did some research on like this one weird Herbie Hancock record, but I can't remember what that name was about. So I don't know. They all come from like weird, goofy trains of thinking, I suppose.
So the ice cream sandwich, do you consider it a sandwich, and do you have one at the shops?
The ice cream, no, we don't, because doesn't that seem like maybe too much sandwich, like to eat a sandwich and then have an ice cream sandwich? We talked about it.
Well, I think you need to do it. You know, the Neapolitans serve ice cream in a warm brioche.
Yeah, and that sounds awesome. I'm not opposed to it, but no, we have never served one.
Well, I hope you think about it.
I will.
But the one thing that you do a lot that we all do at home and are sometimes ashamed to admit it is we put potato chips or corn chips in our sandwiches.
Right, but that's just awesome. I don't know why anybody would be ashamed of that. Before we opened the sandwich shop, I was like, we should open a sandwich shop and we should put potato chips on all the sandwiches. And that just seemed like a really good idea.
And are they on? They're not on all the sandwiches.
No, they're not. But they've always been on a couple of them. And people like that.
William Wegman.
Yeah.
So he did the drawings or the photographs?
He just did the like 10 or so drawings that open each chapter.
They're so fantastic.
He took old cookbooks, you know, he'd cut an image out of it. And then he would kind of extrapolate from there.
Are the dogs part of your customer base?
I mean, I assume that the dogs were sitting next to him while he did those pieces. Their spirit is in there. But I don't think they've ever eaten one of my sandwiches.
Well, thank you so much. You know, it's a hilarious book, but it's not a gimmicky book.
Thank you. I did my best. I wanted it to be funny, but I wanted it to be useful. And I just wanted it to be the best thing that I could make. And that was different from the other things out there.
I'm definitely going to plunder the condiments in the book.
Good. Do. Yeah, and you know, I wonder, because I feel like I've gotten a lot of questions about some of the like more difficult things since it came out, and I guess maybe, I don't know, maybe I didn't do enough. Here's how you make roast beef and how you make mayonnaise and how you make this pickle, but like, if you just do one of those three things and like buy the other stuff, you know, the book doesn't have to be that hard. Because you could just buy two out of every three ingredients and then assemble, you know, and just make one of the recipes and then make the sandwich.
But the thing is, once you have that condiment, you're going to find a million other ways to use it if it's sitting there in your refrigerator.
So yes, so please, make all the condiments.
Thank you very much, Tyler.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And again, thank you so much for having me and for liking the book. I appreciate it so much.
Tyler Cord's book is A Super Upsetting Cookbook About Sandwiches. Want to know something super cool and not upsetting at all about sandwiches? There are so many great ones right here in Los Angeles. that you don't have to make one yourself. After the break, we hear from one of LA's best sandwich makers. Stay close. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. I love learning how other cooks tinker in the kitchen. What makes you reach for mayo when I reach for mustard? How do you slice the pickles for your turkey sandwich? It's those tiny details that can make a sandwich really shine. Earlier this summer, I asked Peter Lemos of LA's Wax Paper to come on the show to give us a reprieve from our quarantine cooking. Hi.
Hi.
It's so great to have you on.
No, it's awesome to be here.
So talk to me about the origin of Wax Paper. I know that you and your wife, Lauren, met while working in restaurants.
We did.
Was it always your intention to open a sandwich shop?
It was sort of in the back of my mind, just from working in restaurants for so long and working in kitchens. I just sort of had an idea about what all the cooks like to eat, what restaurant people like to eat. And that was always like the biggest driving force, I think, for Wax Paper was a place for other industry people to come on their day off. But it just happened. We got the idea, and Lauren and I had just gotten married, and within the first year of marriage, we were married and opened a business together.
So I'm a sandwich freak. I love sandwiches. And
yes.
I love how some bread works better with the insides than other bread does.
For sure.
Can you talk about the components when we're making our own sandwiches at home? Where do you begin when you start thinking about putting together a new sandwich?
For me, the creativity comes from anywhere. It doesn't really have to come from food. It can come from a car that I saw on the freeway, or a color that I saw on a sign, or a piece of music I'm listening to. You know, a lot of people are getting, you know, like in their CSA box from the farm, maybe you have like a ton of cauliflower. So then that's where the inspiration will come from, or garlic. And you can start there. And then I always like to challenge myself to use one ingredient in as many different ways as I can. So, you know, if you have cauliflower, you know, you can cut it in half and roast half of it. You can chop up a quarter of it and chop it up really fine with some garlic and herbs and olive oil and lemon juice. Then you have cauliflower vinaigrette. And then the other quarter of it, you can maybe blend up into a mayonnaise or something. And so there's the spread. So you use that one ingredient in many different ways, and it makes it really interesting and exciting to eat, and also exciting to cook.
So, of course, the condiments on a sandwich are a really important part. I'm a huge fan of condiments. I keep telling
Yes.
people that I should collab with somebody on a condiment refrigerator, because they take
For sure.
up so much of my refrigerator.
Yeah,
there's
us
almost
too.
No room for food. So what are some unique condiments that you've come to sort of fold into your daily practice? And how do you pair them with the other elements that are inside the sandwich?
I think a big one for us is Best Foods mayonnaise. It's
good for you.
The be-all and end-all, it's the alpha and omega of mayonnaise, in my opinion. It's just, we've tried a bunch. It's definitely not the cheapest, but it's just like the most perfect, neutral, blank canvas.
Do you fold a lot of different stuff into it?
Yeah, speaking of
customize?
Condiments, yeah, exactly. So like that's right? You get mayonnaise is like the perfect canvas. And then preserved lemons, definitely always around. I think like a lot of people, Lauren and I have a oversized lemon tree in our backyard. So always a lot of preserved lemons hanging around. And hot sauce, any kind of hot sauce, pickles, cornichons, pickled onions, any of which can just be folded into mayonnaise and just make a perfect spread for any kind of sandwich. But yes, condiments do definitely keep it interesting. And I love to see like the Evan Kleiman signature series.
We'll talk about that later.
Okay.
Can we talk about your method for assembling the sandwich? I always think of sandwiches as being such an architectural food.
Yeah, it's something I've thought about too. And everything I think makes a difference, like the way you cut something or the way you lay it down. So if you take the Ira glass, we slice the wheat bread, you know, half an inch thick, and then, you know, slices of avocado, season the avocado a little bit, alfalfa sprouts, pickled and raw red onions, you know, julienned onions, not like a slice of a onion or a wedge, slices of cucumber, shredded cheddar cheese. So it's all stacked up. And it even makes a difference, too. So if you eat it with the cheddar cheese sort of on the top, it's going to taste different than if you flipped it over and the avocado was on the roof of your mouth. So we do it so that the avocado hits the bottom and the cheese is on the top. And you want to think about that when you're making a sandwich. You know, like, how is somebody going to eat this? Is it going to pull together? Is it going to fall apart? Like, all of our cheese is shredded.
Now, that must really help with slippage.
Yeah, exactly. There's definitely, all of our ingredients, I would say, have a lot of surface area. So there's a lot of space for things to sort of grab onto each other and kind of hold together, which definitely you do not want. The last thing you want is to bite into a sandwich. You know, everyone's seen it and everything falls out the back.
So now we have to address this NPR connection. Whose
yes.
idea was it to name the sandwiches after NPR personalities?
I think it was, you know, Lauren and I, she was working at the Ace when we were sort of, you know, when we were trying to open Wax Paper. And, you know, every morning I'd drive her into work and we would just listen to NPR, just on the radio. And I think it comes from a lot of time being in the car. And we knew we wanted the sandwiches to have a name. I think it's so much more interesting than just ham and cheese or turkey and Swiss or salami.
How do you decide that Terry Gross is a turkey and Kai Ryssdal comes on a sesame roll?
No, it's funny. A lot of the names were chosen. Most of the names were chosen really, honestly, pretty random. I think the original Ira Glass was going to be some kind of pork belly sandwich. And it's funny, Kai Ryssdal comes into the shop and he doesn't like tuna. So we have to kind of live with that one for a minute. But if we knew somebody was an outright vegan, Hedy Lynn Hurdy's is one of the sandwiches in Chinatown. So she's vegan. So we made sure that hers was vegan. But yeah, we didn't put too much thought into designating which person gets which sandwich. And we just hope if they did have them that they would like them.
I have to tell you that Madeline Brand and I talked about sandwiches on Press Play. And we talked about Wax Paper. And she was very upset that she was not represented.
Okay. Well, we got to do it. I think we definitely got to do Madeline Brand. Has got to get on there. And then Evan Kleiman needs to get a much more visible presence.
It's been so great talking to you. Thank you so much for inspiring us for ideas for sandwiches at home and for making us get an itch to come into Wax Paper.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Evan.
That's Peter Lemos. He and his wife, Lauren, are the duo behind Wax Paper. Stay tuned for the Evan Kleiman. Now, this is no knock to sandwiches, but if I were on a desert island and had to choose between bread and tortillas, I'm choosing tortillas any day. We go from sandwiches to tacos when Good Food continues. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Masa. It's the foundation of every tortilla. Making it requires patience and skill. And if you're lucky, access to really, really good corn. The tortilla revolution we've seen in Southern California has been in part aided by Jorge Gaviria, who imports heirloom corn varieties from Mexico so that chefs and home cooks can transform it into delicious tortillas. My pal and partner in our annual Masa Madness here at KCRW is Gustavo Arellano, and he recently sat down with Jorge to talk about the evolution of the tortilla in the U.S.
This is Gustavo Arellano with KCRW and Gustavo's Great Tortilla Tournament with Evan Kleiman of Good Food, and I'm talking with Jorge Gaviria of Masienda. What's up, Jorge?
Hey, Gustavo. How are you?
Nah, good. Just ready to talk masa. Does it surprise you that masa, that people are caring about masa or good masa and good tortillas now more so than probably ever before in the United States?
No, I think it's been kind of a 100-year evolution, and we're kind of finally realizing the fruits of a lot of labor and a lot of movements that have happened to get us to this point.
Yeah, so for over 100 years, basically, Mexicans in the United States and lovers of Mexican food have been trying to just replicate the flavors and also the process of masa up here as it is down in Mexico. And, you know, and can you explain a little bit about that history?
Yeah, I'd love to. So, you know, the way I see it is that modern masa in the United States kind of has three progressions or waves. And I used to be more of a coffee drinker than I am today, but I think a lot of it really kind of relates to how we think about coffee and third wave coffee, right? You've got the first wave, which was just like access to any kind of coffee. It was like Folgers. It was about convenience, just add water, high value, right? And then as we got a little more sophisticated and we got a little more used to coffee, we started getting more interested in things like, where the coffee came from and, what it tasted like. It shouldn't just all taste exactly the same way. And so the second wave started off kind of on that search for authenticity and quality, but like we kind of lost track with it. And things like Starbucks came around and we kind of got more sucked up into the experience of drinking coffee. And third wave coffee was about, this incredible shift in the way we sourced it. We started going directly to places of origin to work directly with farmers, providing, premiums and fair trade experiences to, the folks that we were working with at the very start of the supply chain. And interestingly, masa has taken the same exact approach. Starting with Maseca or Masarina, Maseca was the brand that put Masarina, which is basically just dry masa flour, on the map in the mid-20th century. And they really got the ball rolling in a really big way, though it had been around. And you actually talked about that in your book, Gustavo, with Tamalina.
Yeah.
They certainly weren't the first, but they were the most important and significant to get the ball rolling.
And of course, the company that made Maseca it's a very interesting company, Gruma. Talk or explain what Gruma is and how they came to dominate the tortilla market, both in Mexico and the United States.
Yeah. So Gruma was started by a father and son duo. I guess the lore of the company is that the son was traveling around northern Mexico and happened across this like relic of technology that would allow him to take dehydrated corn or nixtamal and grind it down into masarina, which would allow it to be shelf stable. Of course, this was desirable because masa, if you've ever used it before, you'll know it's really perishable. It's mostly, it's a very high moisture content dough, right? And so if it's got a higher moisture content, it's going to basically spoil within 24 hours, assuming you're not putting out, any additives or stabilizers in it. And so this was kind of like a divine moment for them. They believed that they would be able to really usher in a new industry and a new product around this kind of advanced technology that they built upon. And they did that. And honestly, it wasn't a huge hit overnight. A lot of people thought it tasted like garbage or, like cardboard. And there was a lot of resistance culturally to it, especially in Mexico. But the big break came around the 70s, almost 20 years later, when they started looking to the United States and eyed not just the recent Mexican immigrants who had left Mexico during the Immigration Reform Act of 1965. There was also all of the Americans now who were attuned to eating Mexican food, but didn't really know where else to get it. And so, I think it was interesting. It was, though, the Mexican market in the United States was, I think, where logically they were going after. What they weren't quite realizing was just how big of a demand there would be across, the mainstream America.
Yeah, because you have Mexican food becoming so popular, but you still, all across the country, but you still don't have actual Mexicanos who are making those fresh tortillas. So Gruma's brands, Mission and Guerrero, they become godsends in many ways, or ambassadors really of tortillas to regions that could have only eaten tortillas in a can.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, canned tortillas. I didn't believe it until you wrote about it. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, of course, alongside that was this sort of second progression that was happening. It kind of happened around, there's a bit like if it was a Venn diagram of time, I'd say around the 50s is when a lot of these kind of really OG tortillerias got started in the United States. El Milagro, La Gloria, El Popo. And these were all folks who were starting off, I think it just on their own, realizing that they wanted to eat better quality tortillas. They didn't have access to it beyond a can, perhaps, and they wanted to be able to kind of channel kind of the authenticity and the nostalgia that they had for where they came from. And that could be obviously very different regionally, right? A tortilla is not the same in, you know, the state of Mexico as it is in Oaxaca. You know, as a result, you had lots of tortillerias start across the country, and they were doing great. But when Gruma comes along, you know, around 20 years after they had just gotten started, they really came out running for that market share. And they got it. Between, you know, acquiring a lot of the smaller run operations or just kind of putting them out of business entirely. And in the third case, which I think a lot of people don't realize, Gruma not only makes the product that we know as Maseca, which is this masa harina product, you know, they acquired Mission tortillas, they acquired Guerrero tortillas, and both of those were meant to kind of target two different markets. Mission was actually for kind of the Anglo market, as they called it, and Guerrero was meant to be more for, you know, the authentic Mexican experience. Go figure. But at the end of the day, you know, they realized that what they are, you know, one of the strong suits they had was that they could create technology for making and producing tortillas and sell that to tortillerias. And that technology, it just so happened, was only compatible with Maseca. And so they got a lot of tortillerias involved that were from that second wave who started out really great. But honestly, just in a kind of a race to the bottom around price, they had to figure out ways to, you know, preserve their margin, and it usually came at the expense of quality.
So when does the masa resistance then against Gruma begin in earnest in the United States?
Well, I think the interesting thing is that it wasn't necessarily a resistance to Gruma. It's definitely a fun narrative, and I don't think that a lot of the folks who, I don't think a lot of people would disagree. But I think that the interesting thing is that they've all sort of coexisted in a way that I think informs one another. Modern Mexican food, as we know it, I think it was an extension from the authentic Mexican food movement, which was really concerned with understanding where things come from specifically and kind of faithfulness to tradition. Ironically, there wasn't like a ton of talk around how, you know, masa or a tortilla would be made. And then with modern Mexican, which really kind of eschewed the idea of authenticity and kind of really played with global flavors and ingredients, interestingly, that movement started to take on kind of this authentic approach of making masa in-house. And I'd say that got started really around, you know, 2013, 2014. Restaurants in our own backyard, like Taco Maria, started really getting into it, and not just producing it for themselves, but producing it for other restaurants. There's so much heart in what everybody's doing, and I think it's really cool to see that around a subject that people really weren't talking about 10 years ago, certainly.
Thank you so much for this interview, Jorge.
Thank you, Gustavo.
That was Gustavo Arellano talking with Jorge Gaviria of Macienda. Not only does Macienda supply some of our favorite restaurants and tortillerias with heirloom corn from Mexico, but they have a pretty amazing line of products for home cooks too. Check it out at macienda.com. There are dream jobs, and then there is Jose Rolat's job. Jose is the taco editor. Yeah, you heard me. The taco editor of Texas Monthly. Before that, Jose's Taco Trail column ran in the Dallas Observer. He's compiled the history and guide to American tacos. Hi.
Hi.
You're not going to start by telling me that you hated tacos as a child, are you?
No. No, not at all. I don't really have much experience with tacos outside of the fast food version until I met my wife, who is a Tejana, a native Texan with Mexican-American heritage. And I should add, before we go on, I've got a speech impediment. So
don't worry
about
it. I
hope your listeners will bear with me.
So you end up in Texas. In what city?
Dallas.
And at the time that you got there, was Dallas a good taco town?
Yes. Yes. And like every other New Yorker, I thought Austin was the place to live. Unfortunately, there were no jobs for me as a writer, but there were plenty of jobs in Dallas with a large northern Mexican immigrant population. So there was plenty to eat.
Did you immediately start writing about tacos? When did the job happen? When did you start your Taco Trail column?
So I moved here in 2009, and the column began in 2010. That lasted for a year. And the whole idea around it was to review taquerias accessible via public transportation, because I don't drive. That's why it's called Taco Trail. It was with the Dallas Observer, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing when I started.
Well, you had to, you were eating. You were eating a lot.
Yes.
So with that, just to give us an idea of how much coverage there was, in that year, how many taquerias, more or less, do you think that you covered?
Well, I wrote about 52, but I probably ate at like 5 places a week, at least.
And out of those 5, yeah, how many ended up being something that you would want to feature, that you would write about?
A lot of them. I can't give you a number now because it seems like it was a lifetime ago. But it was something very new to me. So I didn't have much context until I began to read the history.
Mm-hmm.
About the food and what things were supposed to taste like. I made a lot of knee-jerk reactions that I wouldn't make now.
I guess we should pretty much right now deal with what you call the abuelita principle, because that influences so much of how I feel the conversation about, quote, realness goes.
You know, I never realized how obsessed I was with authenticity until I kept arguing that it doesn't exist. Because at some point, we shouldn't have to argue that. But that's what the abuelita principle is that ultimately authenticity doesn't exist. It takes its name from the fact that almost every conversation around Mexican food eventually gets to a point where someone claims his or her grandmother made the best Mexican food there is. End of conversation. But what if your grandmother was a terrible cook? It doesn't matter. Yeah, there is more than one way to make a particular dish. Take, for example, birria, which is super popular in California right now, but mainly using beef. The novice might say that all birria must be made with beef. Or someone from Jalisco, where birria is commonly accepted to originate, might say goat or lamb is the only way to go. The protein doesn't matter, and they're both right, and they're both wrong.
So let's start to talk about American regionality when it comes to tacos. How much do they vary here across the U.S.?
Well, they vary, I would say, almost as much as they do in Mexico, according to ingredient availability, supply, and demographics, just like in Mexico, just like anywhere. The dominant style remains the crispy taco, though.
Really?
So, you know, yes, yes. It's found everywhere, but in many different ways. So, for example, in California, you have taquitos or the old school hard shell tacos. In Kansas City, you have tacos that are filled with ground beef, sealed with toothpicks, fried, taken out, opened up, and filled with lettuce and topped with Parmesan cheese.
That's like a mom taco to me.
Yeah. Well, it's seemingly a lot more popular than I originally thought, but the Kansas City version is a direct result of Mexican workers living next to Italian workers.
How far back do we have to go to find a Jewish kosher taco?
To the 40s, 30s and 40s. So let's say mid 20th century, when Jews and Mexican Americans were living side by side in Boyle Heights, for example.
And then what was the particular style that was mashed up?
It was just pastrami in a tortilla, not like you have now, where there's pickled mustard seeds and, you know, sauerkraut. The only thing missing is a rye tortilla. Wouldn't that be perfect?
Yeah, now that it came out of your mouth, somebody's going to do it.
I hope so, because I want one.
You know, I have to say that during this period of time we're living right now, where we're being encouraged to stay at home, mm-hmm. I find that everything finds its way into a tortilla.
Everything does. And I would say something doesn't fulfill its potential until it's in a tortilla.
I totally agree with you. That's Jose R. Relat, the taco editor of the Texas Monthly. His book is American Tacos. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or in KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team. They are not leftovers. Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Kat Yore, Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, and Gary Masiha. When you finish off those leftovers, remember to support your local restaurants. Be kind to the staff, and please tip as well as you can. I'll be back next week with more good food.